I don't know how many times you may have heard the passage that Ash has just read to us, but my guess is that if you've been around church for a little while, it's going to be pretty familiar to you. Actually, if you've been around the lunchtime service a while, you may even have heard me preach on the same passage, or the first half of it anyway, last summer. So even though you may have heard it a number of times, I wonder if you've ever thought of what a bizarre thing it is that Jesus says to his disciples in verse 27. Because if you think of the situation, here's Jesus in his last moments with the disciples. He's handpicked them and spent every moment of the last few years training them up. They've hung on his every word, followed his every footstep. And now he's got one last chance to give them a stirring speech as to how he expects them all to take all that they've learnt and put it into practice. I don't know what you want to liken it to. Perhaps Churchill sending a rallying call before the Battle of Britain, or Martin Luther King saying, "I have a dream." Or perhaps something more low-key, you know, like a headmaster sending out his school leavers into the big wide world, or, you know, university graduation, something like that. But whatever you imagine it as, it's clearly something where you're going to choose every word very carefully, as you want to make absolutely sure that you send people out on exactly the right note. So, what does he say? What's his rousing punchline? There it is, in verse 27, "You will all fall away." Not exactly what you think he'd been building up to for the last 3 years, is it? But there's no mistaking it. You're all going to fail. I've spent 3 years teaching you as much as I can, and yet you're still going to let me down. Yeah, it's crazy. And I guess it's not surprising that the disciples were a little bit offended, because they'd done everything to follow Jesus. They'd done the best they could do. They'd given up everything. And yet here he was, apparently branding them as abject failures. So the first thing we've got to ask ourselves as we look at this passage is, what sort of training course has Jesus been taking his disciples on? Because it's clearly nothing like any training course that you or I would choose to go on, and probably not something that your work would choose to send you on. Now, I don't actually think we get a very clear answer to that question from this passage, as it's actually a tale of mass confusion and chaos. But there is one thing that's very clear from what follows, and that is that Jesus is absolutely right. Just leave aside the failures of Peter for 1 minute, as we'll come on to him a little bit later. But just start by reading verse 32. What you see there, it wasn't just Peter who said he'd never disown Jesus. You can read there, all the others said the same. Then if you move on, verses 33 to 42, it wasn't just Peter who couldn't keep awake. The other two members of Jesus' elite trio, James and John, they couldn't keep their eyes open either. And we don't hear anything about what the rest of the disciples who they left behind did. So, and then read on, verse 50. Everyone deserted him and fled, it says. Everyone, including the mystery young man who ran off without any clothes on in verses 51 to 52. And then you move on, verse 54. Peter's still there doing his best. But have a look, where are the rest of the disciples? Nowhere to be seen, apparently. Although actually, to be fair, John's gospel indicates there was at least one other person who'd stayed with him, but not a lot of them. So Jesus is absolutely right. All the disciples make a mess of things. And yet the interesting thing is, it's not just the disciples. They're not the only ones. Because as we read on, the other characters in the tale, the priests, the elders, the teachers of the law, they hardly cover themselves in glory either. If you look on to verses 55 to 59, you can see that they're desperately trying to get some evidence against Jesus, but they fail miserably. So what they've done is they've gone and put a search warrant out on Jesus and arrested him without a shred of evidence. And of course, Jesus initially says nothing, so they're completely scuppered. So the high priest ends up getting pretty desperate, and it's only at that point that Jesus decides he will open his mouth after all, and he feeds them the words that they need to accuse him of blasphemy. So what we've got is a pretty depressing tale. Everywhere you look, people are making a hash of things. And actually, the ironic thing is that the only one who doesn't fluff his lines in the whole story is Judas. He's arranged his sign with the mob, and he actually carries it out to perfection. He's about the only one, I think, as he looked through there. So we've clearly got a story of widespread human failure. It's a catalogue of blunders, one after the other. But it isn't just that. It's also the story of one man's specific failure. Because in amongst all the general mayhem, there's no doubt that the subplot running through it all is the narrative of what's going on between Peter and Jesus. I don't know how many of you were here back in January when Barry Cooper did the introduction to Mark's Gospel. But if you were, you'll know that it's generally thought to be Peter's eyewitness account, which is passed down to Mark shortly before Peter's death. So on the assumption that that's true, what we're witnessing here is actually a first-hand account of how Peter felt a complete failure as he let Jesus down time after time on the night of Jesus' arrest. Now, I reckon most of us here, when we're thinking about Peter on that night, would say, well, you know, yeah, that was the time that Jesus said he disowned him three times before the cock crowed. And sure enough, at the moment he denied knowing him the third time, you get cock-a-doodle-doo or something like that. And of course that's true. But actually, if you look at the whole story, the failure went far, far deeper than that. If we work backwards, you can see Peter disowning Jesus, verses 66 to 72. But if you go back up to verse 47, you can see another failure. The story of someone cutting off the ear of the high priest's servant. Now, Mark doesn't actually tell us very much more here, but Matthew makes it clear that Jesus wasn't very happy with what went on. Luke tells us Jesus actually healed the ear, and John tells us the culprit was Peter. So this was actually the second of Peter's blunders that's recorded on that night. But you know, it's possible that as Peter reflected on those things over the years, that in retrospect, he saw neither of those two incidents as the worst. Just have a look back at verses 32 to 41, where they all fall asleep. Now, I guess most of us could write this off as just one of those things. Because on the one hand, you've got superhero Jesus over here, who's all ready for his half night of prayer. And on the other, you've got three exhausted disciples. And they've drawn the short straw, because they've had to go with Jesus while the others were lucky enough to get left behind. You know, I think we can all imagine the situation. My wife is somebody who likes her sleep, and I know she'd have been the first to volunteer to stay with those of the eight who were left behind. But, you know, I think I'd have opted to join her as well, and I suspect most of you may have done too. So there's no shortage of sympathy for poor old Peter here when Jesus singles him out in verse 37, saying, Peter, why couldn't you stay awake? Why did he actually pick on Peter? You know, what about James and John? They weren't sleeping either. Why Peter? And of course, he actually does that three times. Three times he finds them sleeping. But let me take you back to chapter 13 and read you a few verses from there. I never knew this until I was preparing for this, so you may not have come across this before. But what you've got here is Jesus telling his disciples about the end times. And if we pick it up in verse 32 of Mark 13, verse 32, he said, no one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Be on guard, be alert. You do not know when that time will come. It's like a man going away. He leaves his house and puts his servants in charge, each with his assigned task, and tells the one at the door to keep watch. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know when the owner of the house will come back, whether in the evening or at midnight, or when the cock crows, or at dawn. If he comes suddenly, do not let him find you sleeping. Do not let him find you sleeping. What I say to you, I say to everyone, watch. So Jesus is telling a story about going away and his servants being left to keep watch. Does that sound familiar? And what's the crucial part? Whatever you do, don't let him find you asleep when he comes back. So the worst thing that any servant can do is fall asleep when his master's gone away and told him to keep watch. It looks like he told them that story just a couple of days before he took Peter, James and John to Gethsemane. And then he told them specifically to keep watch while he went away. Now, I don't think when Peter broke down and wept in verse 72 that he managed to make the connection. But I'm absolutely certain that by the time he told the full story many years later that he had done, you just have to compare the wording in this account to the wording in the other Gospels to realise that Mark actually makes a far stronger connection between the two incidents than the others do. I suspect as Peter finally fled from the high priest's courtyard that evening, now wide awake, that he started playing back all the scenes from that evening in his mind over and over again and felt worse every time he did so. So he finished that night a broken man. But you know what the amazing thing is? Peter didn't actually need to tell us the story this way. It clearly made a very deep impression on him that night. But after another 20 to 30 years of ministry, and with a little bit of perspective, he could easily have seen things and told things in a very different light. You know, he could just as easily have told it a little bit like this. Boy, that was a hectic night. We'd had a bit of a rough few days, and then we'd had the Passover meal, and of course we'd had a bit to drink. Judas had thrown a straw up and gone off somewhere, and Jesus was saying all sorts of strange things about his death. Of course, looking back on it now, it all makes sense. But at the time, we really didn't have a clue what was going on. Anyway, Jesus knew we were under pressure, so he warned us that we'd all fall away that evening, which was actually a really helpful thing to say, as it was such a comfort later on. Of course, Zechariah had predicted we'd all scatter, so I guess you could say we had to run away to fulfill that prophecy, but none of us had worked that one out at the time. So, of course, we went to Gethsemane. We were all shattered. Jesus left most of the group behind, but he took me, James and John along to keep him company. We did our best, but in the end, it was just too much. It all caught up with us, and we crashed out while Jesus went off to pray. Now, then, of course, Judas turns up with the mob, and it's absolute chaos. I grabbed my sword and had a go at the high priest's servant, but Jesus didn't want to fight, and he even did the most amazing healing on the bloke's ear, just to give one more example of who he was. What an amazing witness that was. So, at that point, everyone ran away, but I stuck with Jesus as much as I could. I even ended up in the priest's courtyard, but my accent gave me away, so by the time I got collared for the third time, I knew the game was up. So I had to get out as quick as I could. Then, of course, I heard this cock-a-doodle-doo, and I remember Jesus had warned me I'd disown him three times before the cock crowed. So I felt absolutely terrible at the time. But you know, after Jesus rose from the dead, he came back, and he took me on one side. And we talked it all through, which was just so encouraging, because he's so understanding. And of course, that was the start of me taking charge of the church. So it's amazing how God works, isn't it? Now, okay, I've written that down. But I'd say, you tell me afterwards, I'd say that every word of that is true from what I can make out, every word of it. And I guarantee you that that's the story that we would naturally tell if we were Peter. Because you see, there was actually a huge amount to admire in what Peter did that evening. He'd been prepared to defend Jesus physically in the face of overwhelming odds against him. He was still trying to do something to help Jesus long after the others had abandoned him. So by human standards, what he did was really quite impressive. It wasn't just not bad, it was pretty good. He'd shown a huge amount of courage, certainly much more than I would have done. But that isn't how he's written the story. He's told it exactly how he saw it then. Why did he do that? Well, surely because it was the pivotal moment in his life. He'd spent his whole time with Jesus doing his best to please him and to live up to his expectations. And he'd done pretty well, and he was even viewed as the leader of the disciples. But he'd finally been crushed as he realized the awful truth. When the crisis had come, just like the others, he'd been found wanting time and time again. He would never be good enough to please Jesus, and he was a broken man as a result of it. But you see, that's the whole point. That is the most important thing that we can ever know. We will never be good enough to please Jesus. And that's why he was so insistent on telling the disciples that on that last night. The most important thing we can ever know is that we're failures. And in these days of self-help and being true to yourself, that isn't really the sort of thing you should say, is it? And I'm sure all of us would far rather talk about our successes than our failures. I certainly would do. But the whole point is that acknowledging who God is and realizing where we stand in relation to him is actually the starting point for everything. You know, the world will run away from failure because they don't know how to handle it. I reckon the Sanhedrin probably ended up pretty pleased that evening with their night's work when Jesus fed them the lines that they needed to hear. But they were absolutely blind to the realities of what was actually going on. Peter, on the other hand, ended up a broken man on that evening, but it was the start of him seeing clearly who he was in relation to Jesus, and he was a new man as a result of it. It was the start of things for Peter, not the end. So yes, this may be a pretty familiar passage if you've been around church for a little while, but if you've never questioned why Jesus should use his most important speech to tell his disciples they are all failures, then please do so now. Because the question Mark asks is the most important question that you or I can ever be asked. Have you ever allowed yourself to be broken by Jesus in the way that he broke Peter? Or are you still running around thinking that you can be good enough to please him?